performs his or her own work has got a great advantage. It was really good. But here I am, and this is what I must do. I strong armed the MIR team into taking a piece of mine, I think. Essentially, it comes from a novella that was commissioned by a Welsh press, Seren, in fact, to address the issue of a medieval story from Wales called the Mabinogion. This is something that's not really read outside of Wales, and it's not actually read very much in Wales anymore either. It's a dry, arid, oral story that dates back from 12th or 13th century, written over about two centuries, in fact. And Seren's idea is to update it. So they commissioned myself, Niall Griffiths, Owen Shears, a few other writers, to take a section from this and do what we wished to the story. So I didn't really want to rewrite a medieval story. I don't tend to write historically anyway, so I thought, right, well, I'll set this in the near future. Probably because we're almost in the medieval period again anyway, with religious wars and piracy in the high seas, you know, that kind of thing. I just felt that it's not hard to imagine a medieval world becoming our destiny in sometime in the near future. Anyway, so that's the starting point. And this section, the book is called The Ninth Wave, but the original was called Pwyll, Lord of Dyfed. And it's a story about a boy that becomes a man and what routines one has to go through and what encounters one has to get there, really. And the other thing that attracted me to the story was that Pwyll is an aristocrat. He's, in a sense, in my mind anyway, similar to our current Prince Harry. And I had some fun, really, thinking about what it must be like to be a royal. He came back from war to find his own land had grown remote. 6 months away was all it took. Now a cold mist was rising sluggishly from the lakes. White frost hung on branches. Fields welded with grey skies, and he felt indifferent. Viewed from horseback, the landscape reneged on him. It failed to revive his spirits. With him rode a dozen men, all paid-up hunting companions, whose names he barely knew. He was missing his time in the army, at the front line in the southwest. He'd been an officer, by privilege of his birth, admittedly. Everyone understood the NCOs were his superiors, really, but no one spoke of it. Older men conditioned by war, they taught him how to control muscle-racking fear by breathing in steam. How in hand-to-hand fighting the best method for overpowering the enemy was to stamp on his foot. To be a good soldier, you had to be a canny one. He led the hunting party along railway sleepers laid over a hoary ground. Every now and then he caught a glimpse of the necklace of industries around the throat of the bay, producing little more than memories now, and the lamb-white beaches stretching further west. Out at sea, cargo ships were slinging in from Yokohama, Shanghai, all those places, Rio, Cape Town. The huge white sails flopped and mooned and inhaled the wind. Clouds in the distance played upon the surface of the water, changing from white to pink and green to a rich aubergine. Since oil had run out, warfare had become medieval again. Armies now breached city barricades with battering rams or scaled them with ladders, while defenders poured boiling water over their heads. Pitch could only be dreamed of. Advanced military technology lay rusting in the grass for want of a gallon of diesel. You could no longer call in air. Ground troops charged enemy lines on horseback. They laced their steeds' feed buckets with Afghan poppy before riding like the wind into a contact or away from a lost one. With no high tech, it was scary again, hand-to-hand fighting with the Moroccans, who came by sea on sail-driven frigates, and once on land were powerful by virtue of some vintage stocks of crude. enough to run a single tank at least, and a single tank nowadays could turn the tide of a war. He hoped he'd kill some of those Moroccans personally, but he couldn't bank on it. He was protected by his men, who did the killing for him, while he had to contend himself with putting down 5.56 millimeter general-purpose machine gun fire from a safe distance, covering his platoon, who rode their stoned fillies on short, violent pilgrimages across enemy lines. They always returned minus one of the men he called uncle. If truth be told, he was scared of violence. That's what he learnt about himself during his short stint in the military. And in that game, if you didn't love violence, nobody would love you. He hid it the best he could, slaughtering a lamb each night to feed his platoon, cooking with the guys in a darkened field after a rout. That was what he lived for, sitting around a roaring fire, swearing with them, hearing accounts of their kills. In the army, you could say what you liked. There was no control over their statements or his. He could be as indiscreet as they were. He'd been removed from the front when the contacts got too hot. He was never in any real danger the whole time. Those men would have protected him with their lives. Granted, they'd been ordered to, but he hoped some of them had got to love him just a little bit by the end of his tour. The land up here was scraped clean by prevailing southwesterly winds, high enough to see the sea at all times, but not the deer. Now noon, and the temperature had soared, burning off the mists. It often reached 29 degrees in mid-September. Seasons were arbitrary these days, as was the time of day. At least to Pul, who didn't work, didn't wake up until he felt like it. Another hour passed, and they reached the woods, and expectation grew. They dismounted to be low to the mossy floor. Above them, pigeons fled the treetops in panic, rattling their bony wings against the topmost branches. A flurry of dust fell down through the shafts of light. He began to smell a sweet smell of flowers on the air. Only good things should come from such olfactory places. While holding this thought, he led the men into a clearing where the sun broke through and where old cars with tires burnt off and engines removed had been stuffed with compost and manure for the cultivation of hothouse flowers, the bi-coloured Soleil d'Or and the Grand Monarch from China. Apache horticulturists lived in the other cars and sold the blooms for a living. Tiernan, his steward, who'd served under his father, moved his horse up the line to walk beside him. "How's your lordship doing?" he asked brightly. "To be truthful, Tiernan, fucking bored to death." "On such a grand day as this?" His thin lips opened into a smile, revealing baby-sized teeth. Tiernan was in his late 40s, and that he could still enjoy a hunt confounded Purh, who was 24. "Why are we hunting anyway, when Sainsbury's wraps it up for us?" Tiernan stared at him indulgently. Purh knew his steward would be judging now which was the best way to reply. His job depended on having the right hunch, and he'd been in that job a long time. In the end, he said nothing, and that was about right. Earlier that day, they'd ridden past isolated farmhouses and through villages. People came out of the road to pay tribute to Lord Purh, but out of duty, not love, not even for a warrior back from the front. They knew he'd been sent to war as a PR exercise. Their fake pride showed in upturned faces. He sneered back at them from the saddle, staring down teenage girls' cleavages to irritate their fathers. The gamekeepers, cooks, gardeners, stable boys, carpenters, plumbers, riding with him, were similarly dutiful, rounded up from off the estate by an ever-cautious Tiernan. Purh pulled the reins down hard to let his horse graze on clover and walked off into the woods in a strop. Soldiers They were the best of men, the only real people in his life who kept it honest for him. "If you wish, my lord," Ternan said, catching up, "we can turn back for the house." "No, forget that. The hunt was all there was. We'll get a kill first." But the herd was proving elusive. They moved on and reached the old slate quarry without sighting a single deer. Here the mountainside had been carved into terraces by a previous generation, exposing its blue, green, and purple belly to the light for the first time in millions of years. Below these terraces was a lake, pigmented a turquoise blue. The lake had been one of his regular haunts since he was a kid, a place where he could be alone with his thoughts. In more recent times, old cookers, freezers, and washing machines had been dumped there and broke the surface of the water. A dark blue Nissan perched at the lake's edge. He could see its deep tracks in the mud. It was still in relatively good condition, even without its tires. From the back fender dangled a severed orange rope. In the windscreen were two bullet holes. He dismounted, wandered over to the car, and opened the passenger door. On the driver's side were order of service cards for a marriage ceremony. "Sinead and Vaughan at Clare Vale Church," they said. Either a bygone wedding or one the bride and groom had never reached. With these wedding cards in hand, he meditated on the silent domestic appliances in the lake. Along the shore, willows had collapsed into the water. The light felt almost frail, and he could hear the sound of a river fading, losing power, unable to reach its final destination of the sea. He strayed far from the party. He allowed his horse to follow, but not the men. From the edge of the lake, he saw fish jumping, struggling to leave their watery prison. A single swan sat on the turquoise water. It too seemed between places, away from home, confused. A breeze skimmed the surface, making ripples. The metallic sound of leaves rustled, a smell of cut pine, noises of animals being preyed upon, airborne attacks on rats and voles. He threw a rock into the lake to stimulate something, make something move. He watched the concentric circles expand until they reached his feet. Distant sounds of sheep and cattle, dogs barking from afar, lots of different birds flying by, murder of crows, pairs of jays and magpies, songbirds singing their hearts out in fear of the jays and magpies. 50 meters away, his men waited patiently for him to give directions. He felt the sun burn his face. He heard the fish clatter and rattle as they swam amongst the submerged fridges, cookers, and tumble dryers. Married couples dumped their wares here. That swan, pearl white, the dirty neck, head in the water, tail in the air. On the crest of the hill appeared a stag, a glorious grey, muscle-bound alpha male etched upon the skyline. Purr felt his heart pull and dive. He sensed the men flinch, saw their arms reach out very slowly for holstered weapons hanging from saddles. They had a clear shot from here, but no one would go before him. The sound of slate shards clicking, the deer turned its beautiful neck. Then Purr heard the dog before he saw it, a bark like a violently snapped branch. A brown freckled ridgeback came off the ground at speed, drooling and snarling, and fell upon the stag, engorging itself. The stag screamed. The scream had no end and was heartbreaking to hear. The way into this was clear in his mind. He unsheathed his finished bolt-action rifle from the saddle and began running along the rim of the lake. He jumped from one boulder to another. When he was high enough to see the dog's spine protruding through its skin, he braced himself with legs apart, drew the bolt, took aim, and shot it through the neck. It fell upon the stag, both animals trembling. The stag scrambled from beneath the weight of the dog, got unsteadily onto its legs, briefly looked around at the world. It seemed to wait for some kind of confirmation. Then it leapt away, flying the arterial red flag. Purch stood with his boot in the throat of the ridgeback, a huge and frightening dog, even when dead. From over an escarpment, another hunting party appeared. They'd come from the east on Arab horses, five men in black North Face jackets. One of these men broke from the group. He stemmed his mount into a slow trot as soon as he saw the dog and slid down from the saddle. Purch stepped away, holding his weapon across his waist, parallel to the ground. Tiernan caught up with him, and they both watched as this other man fell to his knees over the dog. Then they heard him exhale. He pulled the dog's limp head into his chest, kissed it, and then it let it crash to the ground. Rising to his full height, he glowered at Purch, saying nothing. He had bad skin, the ravages of teenage acne. His eyes were remote and bloodshot. Purch broke the silence, giving the other man the advantage. Your dog was attacking the stag. Well, it's called hunting. Isn't that what you're doing? Not with dogs. The stranger threw back his head in the direction of his men, who all looked sprung from the same caged womb, with the same buzz haircuts, square jaws. I don't accept your apologies. I didn't apologize, Purch said. The man caressed the neck of his horse and lowered his voice to a hiss. You're the young bard of war, aren't you? The one they sent away because you were misspending your youth with people you shouldn't know. You have the advantage, sir. Tiernan interrupted, translating the unspoken line. This is Lord Arwon. He has the land east of the river. Arwon, Purch repeated. He did not know the name. The man's hand that was stroking the horse, was covered in hair, his nails broken and dirty. An aristocrat with the hands of a grave digger. How are we going to do this, son? You want compensation, Purch struggled to keep his voice from breaking. No, son, that cock won't crow. His remark grew a snigger from his men. Purch noticed their easy familiarity and envied it. They slid off their horses and lifted the dead animal onto one of the saddles and mounted up again. Without another word, all of them set off, riding slowly towards the escarpment from which they had emerged. Purch was shaking. He wanted to fall into somebody's arms. He said to Tiernan, why should he be pissed off with me for shooting the dog? Arwon's a man of reckless determination. Did you see their jackets? Gore-Tex is hard to come by. Arwon looks after his men, that's true. He gravely lowered his voice, but be warned, this is not over. Their hunt was now completely ruined and everyone knew it. The party headed back to the estate as the weather changed. They rode through the sodden woods under dripping trees onto the highway as a way of making time. Each carriageway was lined with cars refitted for human habitation. People who lived in them had grown Veronica as windbreaks, a few stiff Monterey pines from California. Purch liked being on this road. Fluttering around the cracked wing mirrors of a VW van were blue tits trying to make their own image. This way back skirted the Sandfields housing estate. He knew this scruffy tip was where Tiernan came from and could feel the Stuarts' dis-ease as they rode into it. At its heart was a biomass power station that burned 500,000 tons of clean wood chip each year, producing high-pressure steam to turn the turbines, generating 50 megawatts in renewable electricity. Purch could still remember a time when a petrochemical plant had stood in its place. Then a small boy, his father brought him out here to teach him about industry. From anywhere on the estate in those days, you could hear chemicals humming and a hot recycle in the knotted steel pipes, see 20-foot heads of flame issuing from the plant stack. A river was diverted into the plant so ships could sail right in and have their holes pumped full of benzene and vinyl chloride monomer. That was some tough era. At night, the plant was a mass of white light and steam, actually quite beautiful. But to see things in this way, in the electric green, with a metallic wind in your hair, is what it means to be young. Now his thoughts were turned to more tormenting things, the unarticulated threat posed by Arwen, and that's what it means to grow old. The road passed weaving and embroidery factories, a John Deere tractor workshop, defunct, trailer park, units making bathroom tiles, bamboo flooring. Each street was named after a famous composer. Gangs of teenagers walked their pit bulls down Mozart Avenue towards the war memorial and acknowledged Puch like they would the police. Since his father and mother had died, powers had been invested in him. He was meant to rule here, but he didn't know how. He had yet to inspire any affection. He asked Tiernan breezily, "You still have family here? Only one brother now." This sounded fine to Puch. One brother was one more than he had. Why it cost Tiernan to say so was hard to understand. "I want to visit your brother," he announced. "You want to visit my brother?" Tiernan repeated. Puch could tell his idea didn't appeal. "That's what I said." He did not stop to consider the consequences to Tiernan or his brother of making such an impromptu visit. Dutifully, Tiernan took him to a row of faded grey houses. They left their horses and walked up the garden path of one of them. Puch could feel his resentment in the mute shuffle. "It's no big deal," he reassured him, "just a little social visit." The front lawn was nibbled to the stub, something hungry had this way passed. They reached the door, rang the bell, and a shadow behind the frosted glass panel began to move. The door swung open, and standing before them was a stooped old man with fine grey hair matted with dust. There was dirt in his ears and rimming his nostrils. If he wasn't overjoyed to see his brother and his lord, he tried not to show it. He stretched his arm behind his back, gesturing them to enter. From the street, the windows were badly smeared, so Puch got no forewarning of what lay inside. As he stepped over the threshold, the smell made him gag. Then he saw the horse in the living room. It appeared to be out on its legs, head drooping. Surrounding this world-weary nags were cabinets stuffed with bone china and silverware. The man didn't so much as mention the horse. He repaired to the kitchen, which smelled different, but not much sweeter. There was a thick layer of grease on every surface, and Puch's soles stuck to the floor. "Tea?" the brother offered, dragging the syllable out like a wet rag. As the kettle boiled, he plucked three festering mugs from the sink of dirty crockery and gave them a quick rinse. Since no one else was talking, Puch questioned him about the mare in the front room. "Why isn't she grazing outside?" The brother's face soured and scrunched up. "She'll get cancer. All the carcinogens in the air." "Do you ride her?" Puch asked. "I have a little sideline as a rag and bone merchant, your lordship." Tiernan said, "She'd make you more money as carcass for dog food. You'd earn more from her, dead than alive. Either that, or she should be out on the moors eating clover and grass in her final days." He sounded bitter and angry. This was not the demonstration of brotherly love Puch had hoped to find. The brother poured hot water over the tea bags and dribbled evaporated milk from a can into the mugs. They sat in silence for a while longer, before he got up from the table to go feed his mare. Puch watched him lean into the horse's backside while emptying a saucepan of grain into a feed bucket. There were huge dents in the wall from where his horse had kicked back with its hind legs. Tiernan was looking desperately humiliated. This visit was undermining the impression he liked to give of a man from nowhere, who'd parented himself. All that he was learning today left Puch feeling weightless. He drifted to his feet and made their excuses to set Tiernan free of the past. On the way out, he stalled at the bathroom door. He needed to go, but once he pushed open the door and looked in, thought better of it. Some scenes are best left undescribed. Thanks very much.